Welcome to Defenders, the teaching class of Dr. William Lane Craig. Today, the Doctrine of God, Part 3. For more information and resources, go to reasonablefaith.org.
Well, we've been talking about divine aseity, and before we look at this specifically, I want to say something more by way of how Christian theology determines the divine attributes, because I think Joe's question last week helped to raise a point that needs clarification. Remember I said that the scriptures are often underdeterminative with regard to these divine attributes. For example, scripture teaches that God is eternal, but it doesn't tell us clearly whether he's timeless or everlasting throughout time. That would be just one example. And so the issue can't be decided simply scripturally. So Christian theologians have studied the doctrine of God under the exercise of two controls. The first and foremost would be Holy Scripture. What does the Scriptures have to say about God's attributes? The second would be what we could call perfect being theology. Perfect being theology. And this is based on St. Anselm's idea of God as the greatest conceivable being, or the most perfect being. Anselm, I think, quite rightly said that when you think about the concept of God, God is by definition the greatest conceivable being. If you could conceive of anything greater than God, then that would be God. So by the very concept of God, God is the greatest conceivable being, the perfect being. And if we think of God that way, that means that in developing our doctrine of God, we will want to understand God's scriptural attributes in the greatest fashion possible. He would have those attributes that would go to extol or magnify his greatness, attributes that would be what we might call great-making attributes, that would be consistent with God's being the most perfect being. So when we come to the subject of God's self-existence that we've been looking at, I think we could say that the scripture clearly teaches that God is uncreated and independent of anything else. Everything other than God depends upon God for his existence, whereas God depends upon nothing. He never came into existence. He will never cease to exist. So there is what one might call a sort of factual necessity about God's being. And factual necessity would mean that God exists necessarily in the sense that he is uncreated, he is eternal, he is incorruptible, and he's indestructible. So factual necessity could be cashed out as God's being uncreated, eternal, indestructible, and incorruptible. But there's an even stronger conception of God's necessity, which we can call logical necessity. And that's the necessity that would say that God not only is uncreated, eternal, indestructible, and incorruptible, but that it's impossible for God not to exist. To say God does not exist is like saying a bachelor is married. It's just incoherent. It is logically necessary that God exists. So if God's existence is logically necessary, the statement God exists isn't just true accidentally. It doesn't just happen to be true. It's necessarily true. This is a necessary truth. It's like all bachelors are unmarried. It's a necessary truth. Or that the three angles of a Euclidean triangle add up to 180 degrees. It's a necessary truth. So we might say, well, why should we think of God's existence as necessary in this stronger sense? Not just factually necessary, but logically necessary. Well, the first reason would be because of perfect being theology. It is much greater to have logically necessary existence than to just sort of accidentally exist, even if that means you're eternal and uncaused and indestructible and incorruptible. It's more perfect to exist necessarily. It's greater to exist necessarily. And so perfect being theology would require that God exists necessarily. The second reason is that many of the arguments for God's existence conclude to God as a logically necessary being. Now, we haven't discussed these yet, but we will eventually in this class. For example, the famous cosmological argument based upon the contingency of the world. Why does something exist rather than nothing? Ultimately gets back to a being which must exist and is the sufficient reason for the existence of everything else and whose non-existence is impossible. So if this version of the cosmological argument is sound, and I think it is, it proves that there must be a logically necessary being which explains why anything else exists. Or again, a conceptualist argument for God's existence, where you think of God as an omniscient mind who is the grounding for all necessary truths, and who is the grounding for, say, mathematical objects and things of this sort, would require a God whose existence is logically necessary because some of these truths are logically necessary. If you have logically necessary truths and these need to be grounded in somebody's mind, then that mind, that being, would have to be as logically necessary as the truths he grounds. Or another argument for God's existence, the moral argument, says that we need God to ground moral values. Now, since these moral values are necessary and not just accidental, you need a necessary being to ground these necessary moral values. So, for example, it's morally necessary that torturing a child for fun is wrong. That's just not true in this world. That's true in any possible world, that torturing a child for fun is wrong. That's a logically necessary moral truth. And if God has to exist in order to ground those moral truths, he has to be as logically necessary as those truths. So I think we have very good reasons for thinking, as I explained last week, that God is self-existent, not just in the sense that he is eternal and uncreated and indestructible and incorruptible, but that it is literally impossible for God not to exist. His existence is logically necessary. So I hope that clarifies a bit the procedure for looking at God's attributes and why I say we ought to think of God as a logically necessary being. Now, in our discussion last week, we came to a challenge to the doctrine of God's self-existence. And this is on your outline under point C, the challenge of Platonism. And we have a handout for you on this. If you don't have it, perhaps you could raise your hand and someone will bring this to you. But we'll be looking at that handout this morning. Now, this area of this challenge to divine aseity is the area that is the center of my current research interest. I've been studying this now for several years, and therefore am delighted to have a chance to share with you a little bit about this morning. What is the challenge posed by Platonism to divine aseity? Well, to motivate your grasp of this problem, let me ask you a question. Do numbers exist? What do you think? Do numbers exist? Does the number three exist? For example, there are three people at this table. There's Dennis and Jim and Donald. There are three people at that table. But does the number three also exist? Now, I'm not talking about the numeral three. Certainly the numeral three exists. There it is. Or if you use Roman numerals, there it is. That's a numeral three. But does the number three exist? Do numbers exist? Well, Platonists say yes. Plato was one of the most famous of the ancient Greek philosophers, and Plato believed that things like numbers and mathematical objects, geometrical figures like the perfect circle or the perfect triangle, exist more really, more robustly than the things around us in the physical world. Plato actually thought that the things in the physical world were like shadows, a mere shadowy existence compared to the reality of these abstract objects like numbers and geometrical figures. He thought that these abstract entities were the ultimate reality. Now, what would be some examples of these sorts of abstract objects? Platonists today take their cue from Plato. They don't hold the same view as Plato does exactly, but they would say there are these abstract entities. Mathematical objects would be the primary example of these things. Things like numbers or sets, if you remember studying set theory in your high school algebra class, or functions, or in geometry, geometrical figures. There are different kinds of geometries, planar geometry or geometry of a sphere or of a saddle. All of these are different competing geometries. And those geometrical objects would be abstract objects. But there are other kinds of abstract objects besides mathematical ones, if they exist. Propositions, for example, would be abstract objects. Now, what do I mean by that? Well, a proposition is the information content of a sentence. It's the information content of a sentence. So, for example, the sentence, snow is white, and the sentence, der Schnee ist weiß, are different sentences. One is in English, one is in German. They're not the same sentence, but they both have the same information content, namely that snow is white. So philosophers will say that they both express the same proposition, and that while these sentences are linguistic entities on paper or spoken into the air, propositions aren't linguistic entities. They're abstract objects. It's the information content conveyed by those sentences. And even if no one had ever spoken the sentence, snow is white, that proposition would still be true, even if the sentence is never uttered, if the proposition is never expressed. What would be another example of abstract objects? Well, some philosophers think that properties are abstract objects. The property of being green, for example, the greenness of this plant and the greenness of that plant are the same. They have the same property. But obviously, it's not this greenness that is in this leaf because they're spatially separated. This plant has its own greenness and that one has its own greenness. They're not the same greenness in the sense of the green that you see, but nevertheless, they do have the same color. So in some way, they both have the same property. So some philosophers, like my colleague J.P. Moreland, think that greenness is an abstract object that exists beyond time and space, and that these two plants both exemplify that abstract object of being green. So properties would be another example of abstract objects. Now, what's significant about this? Well, many of these abstract objects, if they exist, exist necessarily. They're not created. They exist necessarily. For example, if the number 2 exists, it exists necessarily. If propositions exist, they exist necessarily. They may be true or false in different worlds, but in the world in which there are no concrete objects, no space and time, the proposition would be true. There are no concrete objects. There is no space and time. So you can't get rid of these propositions. So propositions, properties, mathematical objects, these things exist necessarily if they exist. Now, that is a threat to Christian theology, because Christian theology says that God is the uniquely self-existent, necessary being, and that everything else that exists depends upon him for its existence. In fact, you remember in John chapter 1, verse 3, it says that God created everything outside of himself. Remember, it says, in the beginning was the Word was with God, the Word was God. All things came into being through him, and without him, nothing came into being. So if these abstract entities exist, that means that they exist independently of God. They're self-existent, necessary in their being, and therefore God is reduced to just one being among many. In fact, God would be an infinitesimal part of reality compared to the infinity of numbers and mathematical objects. There are endless infinities of infinities of infinities of these objects, so that God's creation of the physical world will be an infinitesimal triviality compared to the realms of uncreated being over which he exercised no creative control at all. So that this view, Platonism, results in a sort of metaphysical pluralism. That is to say, there is no single metaphysical ultimate. There is no peak of the pyramid that is the metaphysically ultimate being that accounts for everything else. Rather, there's just this diversity of necessary, self-existent, uncreated beings of which God happens to be one. And it seems to me that that is deeply problematic for Christian theology. And for that reason, I think a serious Christian cannot be a Platonist. Now, is there any question about the problem posed by Platonism before we look at possible solutions? Yes, Jonathan. Aren't you Jonathan? Oh, yeah, you got to get the mic. But you are Jonathan, right? Okay. The way you looked at it was as though I got your name wrong, so go ahead.
Well, you said J.P. Moreland holds that the abstract objects actually do exist.
Yeah, I shouldn't have said that, should I?
Well, yes. I'm curious how he resolves this problem, because he seemed to be a fairly good Christian philosopher, so I don't
Right.
know.
J.P. will adopt the first solution that I'm going to propose. So when we get to the solutions, that will be his way out, or he'll try to take that route.
Okay.
If you read our book, Philosophical Foundations for a Christian Worldview, when you come to this section on the attributes of God, on divine aseity, this was the only place in the book we couldn't agree. And so what we did there was I wrote one paragraph, J.P. wrote the next paragraph saying, but I wrote the next paragraph responding to him, and then he wrote the final paragraph responding to me, and we just left it like that. Pardon me? Yeah. That's why. That's why it just seems we're jumping back and forth. We were. Joe.
A couple of things. I've heard you say before that abstract objects are effete, don't have any power. Is that, are you going to stand by that?
Yes. Oh, yes. That's. Let me explain Joe's question. What makes an object abstract? Well, it can't be simply that it's beyond space and time, because God is beyond space and time. But he's the paradigm of a concrete object. He's active in the world. He creates the world. Or angels, too, would be concrete objects, even though they would be immaterial or spiritual substances. So an abstract object doesn't mean an immaterial entity. It doesn't mean an entity beyond space and time. What is an abstract object anyway? Well, the defining characteristic of an abstract object seems to be that it's causally impotent. That is to say, it doesn't stand in causal relations to anything. The number seven has no effects. It can't cause anything. And this seems to be generally agreed, I think, among metaphysicians, that the defining characteristic that makes an object an abstract object is its causal impotence or effeteness.
That being said, you left out moral law, I thought, as an abstract. I don't know how you're going to define that, and laws of logic, both of which seem to have an effect in our world. So I don't know if you're going to – are those abstract or not?
No, I would say those are abstract, and I would say that neither of those have causal effects. Take the moral law, for example. The moral law doesn't cause people to do things or doesn't have any sort of impact on the world. It's just that if you do things in violation of the moral law, then God will hold you responsible for that, and you'll need forgiveness or punishment.
Last question: does that flow necessarily out of his nature, or is that, have you shifted your view of that?
No, I haven't. We'll talk about that when we get to God's goodness. Then I'll ground moral values not in a Platonic realm of abstract objects like justice or fairness or compassion, the way Plato would. I'll ground them in God's moral nature as features of God's character, and he's a concrete object. Yes.
What would you say the perception of an abstract object is?
Perception?
Is it a new abstract object?
This is a very, very interesting question. One of the main objections to Platonism is, if there are these objects out there which have no causal impact on us, how can we know about them? They would be as inscrutable to us as what's happening right now in a village in Nepal. How could anybody know? And yet we do know that 2 + 2 = 4. Well, how do we know that? If two and four exist beyond space and time and have no impact upon the world. Well, this is a real problem for Platonism, but I'm not going to talk about that because my objection to Platonism is theological, not epistemological. But that is a real problem, is that Platonism has a real difficulty explaining how we can have this sort of mathematical knowledge of these objects. Any other question about the challenge here that we're looking at? Do you understand why this is a problem? Yeah, Bob.
Bill, have the philosophers considered human language? To me, numbers don't exist without an intellect, either human intellect or divine intellect. Similarly, languages don't exist without an intellect. If you were removed, if all people who could speak a language or knew a language and all written references to a language were removed from the earth, does that language exist?
Right. We'll see, Bob, that some people sympathize with your point of view. Certainly, obviously, the language itself wouldn't exist unless you think of it as a sort of abstract entity that may not be spoken by anyone. But let me turn to the solutions, and I think we'll see that some people sympathize with your point of view. How can we deal with this challenge that is posed to Christian theology by Platonism? Well, the first solution is what we might call absolute creationism. Absolute creationism. And what this would hold is that God creates these abstract objects, that they are in fact created by God. And he may even create them from eternity past, that they depend for their being upon God's existence. So there are these abstract objects, they really exist, but they are in fact created by God. Now that's an obvious and seemingly very attractive solution, just make these things part of creation. But there seems to be a fatal problem with that solution, and that is that it seems to confront a vicious circle problem. A vicious circle problem. Namely, in order for God to create some of these abstract objects, they would already have to exist. Let me give you an example. Suppose God wants to create the property of being powerful. He would already have to be powerful in order to create the property of being powerful. So that you're in a vicious circle. You can't create the power or the property of being powerful unless you already have power. So we'd already have to have the property of being powerful in order to create the property of being powerful. Or think about numbers. Suppose God wanted to create the number one. Well, before he creates the number one, how many gods are there? Well, there's one. And so one is the number of how many gods there are. Or how many persons are there in the Trinity before God creates numbers? Three. So three is the number of the people and persons in the Trinity. So that the numbers already exist before God creates them. So you're in a vicious circle. And frankly, I don't see any way out of this. It seems to me that this is a decisive objection to absolute creationism. And that therefore it runs into this bootstrapping problem or this vicious circularity that makes it an untenable solution to the problem. So that takes us to our next possible solution. Absolute creationism is not, in fact, the view that Christian theologians have adopted with respect to this problem. Rather, the majority of Christian theologians have opted for the second alternative. And this is close to, I think, what Bob was saying. Conceptualism. That is to say, St. Augustine, influenced by Plato, recognized the importance of these Platonic entities, these abstract entities, but he also understood this was incompatible with the Christian doctrine of God. So what did Augustine do? He moved the realm of Platonic objects into the mind of God and said what these really are God's ideas. So he was led to the doctrine of the divine ideas. So that when we talk about the number one or the property of being green, what you're talking about are the intellectual content of God's mind. And this has been the majority viewpoint of Christian theologians down through history, a kind of conceptualism where these abstract objects have being as the ideas of God. Now, I think that that's a viable option today, though it's not without problems. For example, it doesn't really solve the problem that Steve raised about how you can know about these things. Granted, they're not in some Platonic heaven, but they're in God's mind. So how do we have access to these things to know that 2 plus 2 equals 4 if 2 and 4 is just an idea in the mind of God? Or if I talk about the set of three men at this table, when I form the idea of that set, that's not the same set as the idea that God forms. Because if the set of three men is God's idea, then that's not my idea. I have a different idea. So conceptualism is not without its problems, though I think it is a good position and a defensible position. It's not as though it doesn't face difficulties. And so some have been led to go even farther and to say, well, why think that these things exist at all? Why think that there are such things as numbers and properties and so forth? And this is the position of nominalism. And nominalism says that these abstract objects are just useful fictions. They don't really exist. They're just useful fictions. They're artifacts of language, as Bob was saying. It's just the way we talk. To give an illustration, suppose I say the average American family has 2.5 children. Well, now, that's true, right? The average American family does have 2.5 children. But there isn't any such thing as the average American family, much less 2.5 children. There isn't any family in this country that has 2.5 children in it. So the average American family, quote, is just a kind of useful fiction that we use to describe the mean number of children in U.S. families. Now, look at your chart here for a diagram illustrating the various options with respect to these abstract objects, in particular mathematical objects. This is a chart which is original with me. You'll find this nowhere else. So this is something that's unique here for you to have a look at. Notice there are three positions with respect to mathematical objects. Either they exist, that's realism, there really are these things, or they don't exist, that's anti-realism, or in the middle, some people say, well, this is just a meaningless question. There is no answer to it because the question is meaningless. Now, under those who think that it exists, there are those who think that they exist as abstract objects, and that's Platonism. Or they exist as concrete objects. Now, if you say they're concrete objects, they could either be physical objects or mental objects. If they're physical, that would be physicalism, where you think that numbers and other things are actual physical entities. If you think they're mental entities, then you're a conceptualist. You think they just exist in the mind. Now, if you think they exist only in the human mind, then that would be a human form of conceptualism. If you hold they exist in God's mind, then that's divine conceptualism. And we've already described Platonism and divine conceptualism as two options. On the other hand, suppose you say they don't exist, anti-realism, that's the nominalist view, that these things aren't real, they're just useful fictions. Here you see there's a whole plethora of alternatives, different kinds of nominalism that are available, and I don't even list them all. Let me just highlight two of them. First, fictionalism. Fictionalism says that these statements about mathematical objects and properties and so forth are literally false, but they're useful. They're like statements in fiction. For example, Sherlock Holmes lived in Baker Street, or Sherlock Holmes was a detective. That's literally false, because there was no such person as Sherlock Holmes. But it's true in the story of Sherlock Holmes that he was a detective who lived in Baker Street. So it's fictionally true, even though it's literally false. It would be fictionally false to say Sherlock Holmes was a mechanic who lived in Peoria. That would be fictionally false. He didn't do that. So it would be both fictionally false and literally false. But to say he was a detective and lived in Baker Street, and Mrs. Hudson was his maid, would be fictionally true, though literally false. Similarly, fictionalists would say about mathematical statements like 2 plus 2 equals 4 that this is literally false because there is no such thing as 2 and 4. They don't exist. But they're fictionally true in the sense that given the axioms of arithmetic, it follows in the story of arithmetic that 2 plus 2 equals 4. Figuralism is the other one I wanted to highlight that's different. Figuralists feel uncomfortable saying a statement like 2 plus 2 equals 4 is false. You got to swallow hard to tell somebody 2 plus 2 equals 4 is a false statement. So figuralists say these statements are just figurative ways of speaking, but they are true. It's like someone who says it's raining cats and dogs outside. That statement is true. It is raining cats and dogs outside, but it's a metaphor. It's a metaphorical statement about how hard it's raining. So you shouldn't think that that metaphorical statement is false. It's true. It's a true statement that it's raining cats and dogs. But the person who takes it literally is simply misunderstanding what's being asserted. In the same way, it's true that 2 plus 2 equals 4, but that's a figurative way of speaking. When I say there are three men at the table, that's true, literally. But if I say three is the number of the men at the table, that's just a figurative way of speaking. I don't mean there really is an object called three that exists in addition to the men. So both of these, I think, are viable options for the Christian theologian today. I find both of them quite attractive, and I'm torn which one to go with. But my inclination is to go with some kind of an anti-realism of either a fictionalist or figuralist sort, or if that won't work, to fall back on conceptualism. But I think you can see that there are a number of options open to the Christian theologian today to meet the challenge of Platonism, and that therefore we don't need to lose sleep over this. Yes, in the back here. How would the existence of evil fit into all of this? That would be a different subject, in that evil, if it exists, isn't an abstract object. So I don't think that it's directly pertinent here. It would bear on what Joe was raising about there being objective moral values. What do you think moral values are? For example, cruelty and rapacity and greed, or charity, goodwill, and loyalty. Are these abstract objects the way Plato thought, that kind of are out there existing? Or are these really just characteristics of persons? I'm inclined to the latter view for quite independent reasons of Platonism. And when we talk about the goodness of God, I'll offer a view according to which these moral values are grounded in God's being, the way he is. And so what contradicts that will be evil. Evil is a lack of right order in the creaturely will. It's an absence of right order in the creaturely will. The creaturely will, rather than being ordered toward God as the highest good, is ordered instead toward lesser goods, and therefore is does something that's wrong and falls into evil. Let me ask if there's one more question before we close here with John. Yes.
Bill, I understand that the nominalism of William of Ockham in the 15th century had some virulent strains that were kind of dealt with works righteousness that infected a lot of the communities of the cities of Europe, and especially Erfurt, where Luther studied, and that was part of his misunderstanding of Catholic theology, because he admitted to being an Occamist. Can you say anything there?
Nominalism has a very bad name in theology, but I think it's quite distinct from nominalism in the way I've described it as a view about abstract objects. Ockham, mentioned by John, William of Ockham, was actually a conceptualist. He held that these things have being in the mind of God. So he was in line, I think, John, with the mainstream Christian position of thinking of properties and other abstract objects as being in the divine mind as God's conceptions. And so it's hard for me to understand what's wrong with Occamism. In that sense, I think that he was on the right track in holding to this sort of divine conceptualism. But nominalism took on a kind of broader theological significance, as you say, that was quite negative and is beyond what our discussion is here. Did you want to follow up on that? Okay. All right. Well, next week, Joe's going to be doing some teaching on the treasure principle, and so I'll invite you to come back then. But then when we meet again, we will look at some application to our lives of this attribute of divine self-existence. But I hope that our study of God's self-existence and necessity has served to exalt your understanding of God's being and His greatness, and to expand your mind to see how truly marvelous the Lord is as the self-existent, necessary source of all being other than Himself.
The copyright for the content of this recording is held by Dr. William Lane Craig. For more, go to reasonablefaith.org.